Most of the windows were still shuttered and dark, although here and there, golden candlelight marked the room of some early riser. Sparhawk noted that his armor had already begun to smell. That familiar compound of steel, oil, and the leather harness that had soaked up his sweat for years. He had nearly forgotten that smell in the sun-blasted streets and spice-fragrant shops of Jurok. Almost more than the familiar sights of Samira, it finally convinced him that he was home. An occasional dog came out into the street to bark at them as they passed, but Farron disdainfully ignored them as he trotted through the cobblestone streets. The palace lay in the center of town. It was a very grandiose sort of building, much taller than those around it, with high, pointed towers surmounted by damply flapping colored pennons. It was walled off from the rest of the city, and the walls were surmounted by battlements. At some time in the past, one of the kings of Alenia had ordered the exterior of those walls to be sheathed in white limestone. The climate and the pervasive pall of smoke that lay heavy over the city in certain seasons, however, had turned the sheathing a dirty, streak gray. The palace gates were broad and patrolled by a half-dozen guards wearing the dark blue livery that marked them as members of the regular palace garrison.
"Halt!"
one of them barked as Sparhawk approached. He stepped into the center of the gateway, holding his pike slightly advanced. Sparhawk gave no indication that he had heard, and Farron bore down on the man.
"I said to halt, Sir Knight,"
the guard commanded again. Then one of his fellows jumped forward, seized his arm, and pulled him out of the roan's path.
"It's the Queen's champion," the second guard exclaimed. "Don't ever stand in his way."
Sparhawk reached the central courtyard and dismounted, moving a bit awkwardly because of the weight of his armor and the encumbrance of his shield. A guard came forward, his pike at the ready. "Good morning, neighbor," Sparhawk said to him in his quiet voice. The guard hesitated. "Watch my horse," the knight told him then. "I shouldn't be too long." He handed the guard Farron's reins and started up the broad staircase toward the heavy double doors that opened into the palace.
"Sir Knight," the guard called after him.
Sparhawk did not turn, but continued on up the stairs. There were two blue-liveried guards at the top, older men, he noted, men he thought he recognized. One of the guards' eyes widened, then he suddenly grinned.
"Welcome back, Sir Sparhawk," he said, pulling the door open for the black-armored knight.
Sparhawk gave him a slow wink and went on inside, his mail-shod feet and his spurs clinking on the polished flagstones. Just beyond the door, he encountered a palace functionary with curled and pomaded hair and wearing a maroon-colored doublet. "I will speak with Lycius," Sparhawk announced in a flat tone.
"Take me to him."
"But..."
The man's face had gone slightly pale. He drew himself up, his expression growing lofty.
"How did you..."
"Didn't you hear me, neighbor?" Sparhawk asked him. The man in the maroon doublet shrank back.
"At once, Sir Sparhawk," he stammered.
He turned then and led the way down the broad central corridor. His shoulders were visibly trembling. Sparhawk noted that the functionary was not leading him towards the throne room, but rather toward the council chamber where King Aldrius had customarily met with his advisers. A faint smile touched the big man's lips as he surmised that the presence of the young queen, sitting encased in crystal on the throne, might have had a dampening effect on her cousin's attempts to usurp her crown. They reached the door to the council chamber and found it guarded by two men wearing the red livery of the church, the soldiers of the primate Annius. The two automatically crossed their pikes to bar entry to the chamber.
"The queen's champion to see the prince regent," the functionary said to them, his voice shrill.
"We have no orders to admit the queen's champion," one of them declared.
"You have now," Sparhawk told him. "Open the door." The man in the maroon doublet made a move as if to scurry away, but Sparhawk caught his arm.
"I haven't dismissed you yet, neighbor," he said.
Then he looked at the guards. "Open the door," he repeated. It hung there for a long moment, while the guards looked first at Sparhawk and then nervously at each other. Then one of them swallowed hard and, fumbling with his pike, he reached for the door handle. "You'll need to announce me," Sparhawk told the man whose arm he still held firmly in his gauntleted fist. "We wouldn't want to surprise anyone, would we?" The man's eyes were a little wild. He stepped into the open doorway and cleared his throat. "The Queen's Champion!" he blurted with his words tumbling out over each other. "The Pandion Knight, Sir Sparhawk!" "Thank you, neighbor," Sparhawk said. "You can go now." The functionary bolted. The council chamber was very large and was carpeted and draped in blue. Large candelabras lined the walls, and there were more candles on the long, polished table in the center of the room. Three men sat at the table with documents before them, but the fourth had half risen from his chair. The man on his feet was the primate Annius. The churchman had grown leaner in the 10 years since Sparhawk had last seen him, and his face looked gray and emaciated. His hair was tied back from his face and was now shot with silver. He wore a long black cassock, and the bejeweled pendant of his office as primate of Samira hung from a thick gold chain about his neck. His eyes were wide with surprised alarm as Sparhawk entered the room. The Earl of Lenda, a white-haired man in his 70s, was dressed in a soft gray doublet, and he was grinning openly, his bright blue eyes sparkling in his lined face. The Baron Harperin, a notorious pederast, sat with an astonished expression on his face. His clothing was a riot of conflicting colors. Seated next to him was a grossly fat man in red, whom Sparhawk did not recognize.
"Sparhawk!" Annius said sharply, recovering from his surprise. "What are you doing here?"
"I understand that you've been looking for me, Your Grace," Sparhawk replied. "I thought I'd save you some trouble."
"You've broken your exile, Sparhawk," Annius accused angrily.
"That's one of the things we need to talk about. I'm told that Lycius the Bastard is functioning as Prince Regent until the Queen regains her health. Why don't you send for him so we won't have to go through all this twice?" Annius's eyes widened in shock and outrage. "That's what he is, isn't it?" Sparhawk said. "His origins are hardly a secret, so why tiptoe around them? The bell pull, as I recall, is right over there. Give it a yank, Annius, and send some toady to fetch the Prince Regent." The Earl of Lenda chuckled openly. Annius gave the old man a furious look and went to the pair of bell pulls hanging down the far wall. His hand hesitated between the two. "Don't make any mistakes, Your Grace," Sparhawk warned him. "All sorts of things could go terribly wrong if a dozen soldiers come through that door instead of a servant."
"Go ahead, Annius," the Earl of Lenda urged. "My life is almost over anyway, and I wouldn't mind going out with a bit of excitement."
Annius clenched his teeth and yanked the blue bell pull instead of the red one. After a moment, the door opened, and a liveried young man entered.
"Yes, Your Grace," he said, bowing to the primate.
"Go and tell the Prince Regent that we require his presence here at once."
"But..."
"At once."
"Yes, Your Grace."
The servant scurried out. "There, you see how easy that was?" Sparhawk said to Annius. Then he went over to the white-haired Earl of Lenda, removed his gauntlet, and took the old man's hand. "You're looking well, my lord," he said.
"Still alive, you mean," Lenda laughed. "How was Rendor, Sparhawk?"
"Hot, dry, and very dusty."
"Always has been, my boy. Always has been." "Are you going to answer my question?" Annius demanded.
"Please, Your Grace," Sparhawk responded piously, holding up one hand. "Not until the bastard regent arrives. We must mind our manners, mustn't we?" He lifted one eyebrow. "Tell me," he added, almost as an afterthought, "how's his mother? Her health, I mean."
I wouldn't expect a churchman to be able to testify to the carnal talents of the Princess Arissa, although just about everybody else in Samira could. You go too far, Sparhawk. You mean you didn't know? My goodness, old boy, you really should try to stay abreast of things.
How rude, Baron Harperin exclaimed to the fat man in red.
It's not the sort of thing you'd understand, Harperin, Sparhawk told him. I hear that your inclinations lie in other directions.
The door opened, and a pimpled young man, with muddy blonde hair and a slack-lipped mouth, entered. He wore a green, ermine-trimmed robe and a small gold coronet.
You wanted to see me, Annius?
His voice had a nasal, almost whining quality to it.
A state matter, your highness, Annius replied. We need to have you pass judgment in a case involving high treason.
The young man blinked stupidly at him.
This is Sir Sparhawk, who has deliberately violated the command of your late uncle, King Aldrius. Sparhawk here was ordered to Rendor, not to return unless summoned back by royal command. His very presence in Alenia convicts him.
Lychius recoiled visibly from the bleak-faced knight in black armor, his eyes going wide and his loose mouth gaping.
Sparhawk, he quailed.
The very same, Sparhawk told him. The good primate, however, has slightly overstated the case, I'm afraid. When I assumed my position as hereditary champion of the crown, I took an oath to defend the king, or the queen, whenever the royal life was endangered. That oath takes precedence over any command, royal or otherwise. And the queen's life is clearly in danger.
That's merely a technicality, Sparhawk, Annius snapped.
I know, Sparhawk replied blandly, but technicalities are the soul of the law. The Earl of Lenda cleared his throat.
I have made a study of such matters, he said, and Sir Sparhawk has correctly cited the law. His oath to defend the crown does in fact take precedence.
Prince Lychius had gone around to the other side of the table, giving Sparhawk a wide berth.
That's absurd, he declared. Elana's sick. She's not in any physical danger.
He sat down in the chair next to the primate. The queen, Sparhawk corrected him.
What?
Her proper title is Her Majesty, or at least Queen Elana. It's extremely discourteous simply to call her by name. Technically, I suppose, I'm obliged to protect her from discourtesy as well as physical danger. I'm a little vague on that point of law, so I'll defer to the judgment of my old friend, the Earl of Lenda, on the matter before I have my seconds deliver my challenge to your highness. Lychius went pasty white.
Challenge? This is sheer idiocy, Annius declared. There will be no challenges delivered or accepted.
His eyes narrowed then.
The Prince Regent's point is well taken, however, he said. Sparhawk has simply seized this flimsy excuse to violate his banishment. Unless he can present some documentary evidence of having been summoned, he stands convicted of high treason.
The primate's smile was thin.
I thought you'd never ask, Annius, Sparhawk said.
He reached under his sword belt and drew out a tightly folded parchment tied with a blue ribbon. He untied the ribbon and opened the parchment, the blood-red stone on his ring flashing in the candlelight.
This all seems to be in order, he said, perusing the document. It has the queen's signature on it and her personal seal. Her instructions to me are quite explicit.
He stretched out his arm, offering the parchment to the Earl of Lenda. What's your opinion, my lord? The old man took the parchment and examined it.
The seal is the queen's, he confirmed, and the handwriting is hers. She commands Sir Sparhawk to present himself to her immediately upon her ascension to the throne. It's a valid royal command, my lords.
Let me see that, Annius snapped.
Lenda passed it on down the table to him. The primate read the document with tightly clenched teeth.
It's not even dated, he accused.
Excuse me, your grace, Lenda pointed out. But there is no legal requirement that a royal decree or command be dated. Dating is merely a convention.
Where did you get this?
The primate asked Sparhawk, his eyes narrowing.
I've had it for quite some time.
It was obviously written before the queen ascended the throne.
It does appear that way, doesn't it?
It has no validity.
The primate took the parchment in both hands, as if he would tear it in two.
What's the penalty for destroying a royal decree, my lord of Lenda? Sparhawk asked mildly.
Death.
I rather thought it might be. Go ahead and rip it up, Annius. I'll be more than happy to carry out the sentence myself, just to save time and the expense of all the tiresome legal proceedings.
His eyes locked with those of Annius. After a moment, the primate threw the parchment on the table in disgust. Lychius had watched all of this with a look of growing chagrin. Then he seemed to notice something for the first time.
Your ring, Sir Sparhawk, he said in his whining voice. That is your badge of office, is it not?
In a manner of speaking, yes. Actually, the ring, and the queen's ring, are symbolic of the link between my family and hers.
Give it to me.
No. Lychia's eyes bulged.
I gave you a royal command, he shouted.
No. It was a personal request, Lychius. You can't give royal commands because you're not the king.
Lychius looked uncertainly at the primate, but Annius shook his head slightly. The pimpled young man flushed.
The prince regent merely wished to examine the ring, Sir Sparhawk. The churchman said smoothly, We have sought its mate, the ring of King Aldrius, but it seems to be missing. Would you have any idea where we might find it?
Sparhawk spread his hands. Aldrius had it on his finger when I left for Cypria, he replied. The rings are not customarily taken off, so I assume he was still wearing it when he died.
No, he was not.
Perhaps the queen has it then.
Not so far as we're able to determine.
I want that other ring, Lychius insisted, as a symbol of my authority.
Sparhawk looked at him, his face amused.
What authority? He asked bluntly.
The ring belongs to Queen Alana, and if someone tries to take it from her, I imagine that I'll have to take steps. He suddenly felt a faint prickling of his skin. It seemed that the candles in their gold candelabra flickered slightly, and the blue-draped council chamber grew perceptibly dimmer. Instantly, he began to mutter under his breath in the styric tongue, carefully weaving the counterspell even as he searched the faces of the men sitting around the council table for the source of the rather crude attempt at magic. When he released the counterspell, he saw Annius flinch, and he smiled bleakly. Then he drew himself up.
Now, he said, his voice crisp, let's get down to business. Exactly what happened to King Aldrius?
The Earl of Lenda sighed.
It was the falling sickness, Sir Sparhawk, he replied sadly. The seizures began several months ago, and they grew more and more frequent. The king grew weaker and weaker, and finally...
He shrugged.
He didn't have the falling sickness when I left Samira, Sparhawk said.
The onset was sudden, Annia said coldly.
So it seems. It's rumored that the queen fell ill with the same affliction.
Annius nodded. Didn't that strike any of you as odd? There's never been a history of the disease in the royal family. And isn't it peculiar that Aldrius didn't develop symptoms until he was in his 40s, and his daughter fell ill when she was little more than 18?
I have no medical background, Sparhawk, Annius told him. You may question the court physicians if you wish, but I doubt that you're going to unearth anything that we haven't already discovered.
Sparhawk grunted. He looked around the council chamber.
I think that covers everything we need to discuss here, he said. I'll see the queen now.
Absolutely not, Lychius said.
I'm not asking you, Lychius, the big knight said firmly. May I have that? He pointed at the parchment still lying on the table in front of the primate. They passed it down to him, and he ran through it quickly.
Here it is, he said,
picking out the sentences he wanted.
You are commanded to present yourself to me immediately upon your return to Samira.
That doesn't leave any room for argument, does it?
What are you up to, Sparhawk? The primate asked suspiciously.
I'm just obeying orders, Your Grace. I'm commanded by the Queen to present myself to her, and I'm going to do precisely that.
The door to the throne room is locked, Lycia snapped.
The smile Sparhawk gave him was almost benign.
That's all right, Lycius, he said. I've got a key.
He put his hand suggestively on the silver-bound hilt of his sword.
You wouldn't.
Try me.
Annius cleared his throat.
If I may speak, Your Highness, he said.
Of course, Your Grace, Lycius replied quickly. The crown is always open to the advice and counsel of the church.
Crown?
Sparhawk asked.
A formula, Sir Sparhawk, Annius told him. Prince Lycia speaks for the crown for as long as the queen is incapacitated.
Not to me, he doesn't.
Annius turned back towards Lycius.
It is the advice of the church that we accede to the somewhat churlish request of the queen's champion, he said. Let no one accuse us of incivility. Moreover, the church advises that the prince regent and all of the council accompany Sir Sparhawk to the throne room. He is reputed to be adept at certain forms of magic and to protect the queen's life. We must not permit him to employ precipitously those arts without full consultation with the court physicians.
Lycius made some pretense of thinking it over. Then he rose to his feet.
It shall be as you advise then, Your Grace, he declared. You are directed to accompany us, Sir Sparhawk.
Directed? Lycius ignored that and swept regally towards the door. Sparhawk let Baron Harperin and the fat man in red pass, then fell in beside Primate Annius. He was smiling in a relaxed fashion, but there was little in the way of good humor in the low voice that came from between his teeth.
Don't ever try that again, Annius, he said.
What? The primate sounded startled. Your magic. You're not very good at it in the first place, and it irritates me to have to waste the effort of countering the work of amateurs. Besides, churchmen are forbidden to dabble in magic, as I recall.
You have no proof, Sparhawk.
I don't need proof, Annius. My oath as a Pandion knight would be sufficient in any civil or ecclesiastical court.
Why don't we just leave it there?
But don't mutter any more incantations in my direction. With Lycius in the lead, the council and Sparhawk went down a candlelit corridor to the broad, double doors of the throne room. When they reached the doors, Lycius took a key from inside his doublet and unlocked them.
All right, he said to Sparhawk. It's open. Go present yourself to your queen, for all the good it's going to do you.
Sparhawk reached up and took a burning candle from a silver sconce jutting from the wall of the corridor and went into the dark room beyond the doors. It was cool, almost clammy inside the throne room, and the air smelled musty and stale. Methodically, Sparhawk went along the walls, lighting candles. Then he went to the throne and lit the one standing in the candelabras flanking it.
You don't need that much light, Sparhawk, Lycius said irritably from the doorway.
Sparhawk ignored him. He put out his hand, tentatively touched the crystal which encased the throne, and felt Sophrenia's familiar aura permeating the crystal. Then slowly he raised his eyes to look into Alana's pale young face. The promise that had been there when she had been a child had been fulfilled. She was not simply pretty, as so many young girls are pretty. She was beautiful. There was an almost luminous perfection about her countenance. Her pale blonde hair was long and loosely framed her face. She wore her state robes, and the heavy gold crown of Alenia encircled her head. Her slender hands lay upon the arms of her throne, and her eyes were closed. He remembered that at first he had bitterly resented the command of King Aldrius that had made him the young girl's caretaker. He had quickly found, however, that she was no giddy child, but rather a serious young lady with a quick, retentive mind and an overwhelming curiosity about the world. After her initial shyness had passed,
She had begun to question him closely about palace affairs, and thus, almost by accident, had begun her education in statecraft and the intricacies of palace politics. After a few months, they had grown very close, and he had found himself looking forward to their daily private conversations, during which he had gently molded her character and had prepared her for her ultimate destiny as Queen of Elenia. To see her as she was now, locked in the semblance of death, wrenched at his heart. And he swore to himself that he would take the world apart if need be, to restore her to health and to her throne. For some reason, it made him angry to look at her, and he felt an irrational desire to lash out at things as if by sheer physical force he could return her to consciousness. And then he heard and felt it. The sound appeared to grow more pronounced, and it grew louder moment by moment. It was a regular, steady thudding sound, not quite like the beating of a drum, and it did not change nor falter, but echoed through the room, its volume steadily increasing as it announced to any who might enter that Elana's heart was still beating. Sparhawk drew his sword and saluted his queen with it. Then he sank to one knee in a move of profoundest respect and a peculiar form of love. He leaned forward and gently kissed the unyielding crystal, his eyes suddenly filling with tears. "I am here now, Elana," he murmured, "and I'll make everything all right again." The heartbeat grew louder, almost as if in some peculiar way she had heard him. From the doorway, he heard Lycius snicker derisively, and he promised himself that should the opportunity arise, he would do a number of unpleasant things to the queen's bastard cousin. Then he rose and went towards the door again. Lycia stood smirking at him and still holding the key to the throne room in his hand. As Sparhawk passed the prince, he reached out and took the key. "You won't need this anymore," he said. "I'm here now, so I'll take care of it." "Annius!" Lycius said in a voice shrill with protest. Annius, however, took one look at the bleak face of the queen's champion and decided not to press the issue. "Let him keep it," he said shortly. "But I said let him keep it," the primate snapped. "We don't need it anyway. Let the queen's champion hold the key to the room in which she sleeps." There was a vile innuendo in the churchman's voice, and Sparhawk clenched his still gauntleted left fist. "Will you walk with me as we return to the council chamber, Sir Sparhawk?" the Earl of Lenda said, placing a lightly restraining hand on Sparhawk's armored forearm. "My steps sometimes falter, and it's comforting to have a strong young person at my side." "Certainly, my lord," Sparhawk replied, unclenching his fist. When Lycius had led the members of the council back down the corridor toward their meeting room, Sparhawk closed the door and locked it. Then he handed the key to his old friend. "Will you keep this for me, my lord?" he asked.
"Gladly, Sir Sparhawk."
"And if you can, keep the candles burning in the throne room. Don't leave her sitting there in the dark."
"Of course."
They started down the corridor.
"Do you know something, Sparhawk?" the old man said. "They left a great deal of bark on you when they were giving you the last polishing touches."
Sparhawk grinned at him.
"You can be truly offensive when you set your mind to it."
Lenda chuckled. "I can but try, my lord."
"Be very careful here in Samira, Sparhawk,"
the old man cautioned seriously in a low voice.
"Annius has a spy on every street corner. Lycius won't even sneeze without his permission, so the primate is the real ruler here in Elenia, and he hates you."
"I'm not overly fond of him either," Sparhawk thought of something. "You've been a good friend here today, my lord. Is that going to put you in any kind of danger?" The Earl of Lenda smiled.
"I doubt it. I'm too old and powerless to be any kind of threat to Annius. I'm hardly more than an irritation, and he's far too calculating to take action against me for that."
The primate awaited them at the door to the council chamber.
The council has discussed the situation here, Sir Sparhawk, he said coldly. The queen is quite obviously in no danger. Her heartbeat is strong, and the crystal which encloses her is quite impregnable. She has no real need of a protector at this particular time. It is the command of the council, therefore, that you return to the chapter house of your order here in Samira, and remain there until you receive further instructions. A chill smile touched his lips. Or until the queen herself summons you, of course.
Of course, Sparhawk replied distantly. I was about to suggest that myself, Your Grace. I'm just a simple knight, and I'll be far more at ease in the chapter house with my brothers than here in the palace. He smiled. I'm really quite out of place at court.
I noticed that. I thought you might have.
Sparhawk briefly clasped the hand of the Earl of Lenda by way of farewell. Then he looked directly at Annius.
Until we meet again, then, Your Grace.
If we meet again.
Oh, we will, Annius. Indeed, we will.
Then Sparhawk turned on his heel and walked on down the corridor.
Chapter 3 The chapter house of the Pandian Knights in Samira lay just beyond the eastern gate of the city. It was, in every sense of the word, a castle, with high walls surmounted by battlements and with bleak towers at each corner. It was approached by way of a drawbridge which spanned a deep fosse bristling with sharpened stakes. The drawbridge had been lowered, but it was guarded by 4 black-armored Pandians mounted on war horses. Sparhawk reined Farron in at the other end of the bridge and waited. There were certain formalities involved in gaining entry into a Pandian chapter house. Oddly, he found that he did not chafe at those formalities. They had been a part of his life for all the years of his novitiate, and the observance of these age-old ceremonies seemed somehow to mark a renewal and a reaffirmation of his very identity. Even as he awaited the ritual challenge, the sun-baked city of Jirak and the women going to the wells in the steel-gray light of morning faded back in his memory, becoming more remote and taking their proper place among all his other memories. 2 of the armored knights rode forward at a stately pace, the hooves of their chargers booming hollowly on the foot-thick planks of the drawbridge. They halted just in front of Sparhawk.
"Who art thou who entreateth entry into the house of the soldiers of God?" one of them intoned.
Sparhawk raised his visor in the symbolic gesture of peaceable intent.
"I am Sparhawk," he replied, "a soldier of God and a member of this order."
"How may we know thee?" the second knight inquired.
"By this token may you know me."
Sparhawk reached his hand into the neck of his surcoat and drew out the heavy silver amulet suspended on the chain about his neck. Every Pandian wore such an amulet. The pair made some pretense of looking carefully at it.
"This is indeed Sir Sparhawk of our order," the first knight declared.
"Truly," the second agreed. "And shall we then, he faltered, frowning.
"Grant him entry into the house of the soldiers of God," Sparhawk prompted.
The second knight made a face. "I can never remember that part," he muttered.
"Thanks, Sparhawk."
He cleared his throat and began again.
"Truly," he said, "and shall we then grant him entry into the house of the soldiers of God?"
The first knight was grinning openly.
"It is his right freely to enter this house," he said, "for he is one of us. Hail, Sir Sparhawk! Prithee, come within the walls of this house, and may peace abide with thee beneath its roof,
and with thee, and thy companion as well, wheresoever you may fare," Sparhawk replied, concluding the ceremony.
"Welcome home, Sparhawk," the first knight said warmly then. "You've been a long time away."
"You noticed," Sparhawk answered. "Did Curic get here?" The second knight nodded.
"An hour or so ago. He talked with Vanyan and then left again."
"Let's go inside," Sparhawk suggested.
I need a large dose of that piece you mentioned earlier, and I've got to see Vanyan. The two knights turned their horses, and the three rode together back across the drawbridge. Is Afrenia still here? Sparhawk asked. Yes, the second knight replied. She and Vanyan came from Deimos shortly after the queen fell ill, and she hasn't gone back to the mother house yet. Good. I need to talk with her as well. The three of them halted at the castle gate. This is Sir Sparhawk, a member of our order, the first knight declared to the two who had remained at the gate. We have confirmed his identity and vouch for his right to enter the house of the Knights Pandion. Pass then, Sir Sparhawk, and may peace abide with thee whilst thou remain within this house. I thank thee, Sir Knight, and may peace also be thine. The knights drew their mounts aside, and Farron moved forward without any urging. You know the ritual as well as I do, don't you? Sparhawk murmured. Farron flicked his ears. In the central courtyard, an apprentice knight, who had not yet been vested with his ceremonial armor or spurs, hurried forward and took Farron's reins. Welcome, Sir Knight, he said. Sparhawk hooked his shield to his saddle bow and swung down from Farron's back with his armor clinking. Thank you, he replied. Do you have any idea where I might find Lord Vanyan?
I believe he's in the South Tower, my lord.
Thanks again. Sparhawk started across the courtyard, then stopped. Oh, be careful of the horse, he warned. He bites. The novice looked startled, then cautiously stepped away from the big, ugly roan, though still firmly holding the reins. The horse gave Sparhawk a flat, unfriendly stare. It's more sporting this way, Farron, Sparhawk explained. He started up the worn steps that led into the centuries-old castle. The inside of the chapter house was cool and dim, and the few members of the order Sparhawk met in those halls wore cowled monk's robes, as was customary inside a secure house, although an occasional steely clink betrayed the fact that, beneath their humble garb, the members of this order wore chainmail and were inevitably armed. There were no greetings exchanged, and the cowled brothers of Pandion went resolutely about their duties with bowed heads and shadowed faces. Sparhawk put the flat of his hand out in front of one of the cowled men. Pandion seldom touched each other. Excuse me, brother, he said. Do you know if Vanyan is still in the South Tower? He is, the other knight replied. Thank you, brother. Peace be with you. And with you, Sir Knight. Sparhawk went on along the torchlit corridor until he came to a narrow stairway which wound up into the South Tower between walls of massive, unmortared stones. At the top of the stairs, there was a heavy door guarded by two young Pandians. Sparhawk did not recognize either of them. I need to talk with Vanyan, he told them. The name is Sparhawk. Can you identify yourself? One of them asked, trying to make his youthful voice sound gruff. I've just done so. It hung there while the two young knights struggled to find a graceful way out of the situation. Why not just open the door and tell Vanyan that I'm here? Sparhawk suggested. If he recognizes me, fine. If he doesn't, the two of you can try to throw me back down the stairs. He laid no particular emphasis on the word try. The two looked at each other, then one of them opened the door and looked inside. A thousand pardons, my Lord Vanyan, he apologized. But there's a Pandian here who calls himself Sparhawk. He says that he wants to talk with you.
Good, a familiar voice replied from inside the room. I've been expecting him. Send him in.
The two knights looked abashed and stepped out of Sparhawk's way. Thank you, my brothers. Sparhawk murmured to them. Peace be with you. And then he went on through the door. The room was large, with stone walls, dark green drapes at the narrow windows, and a carpet of muted brown. A fire crackled in the arched fireplace at one end, and there was a candle-lit table surrounded by heavy chairs in the center. Two people, a man and a woman, sat at the table. Vanyan,
The preceptor of the Pandian Knights had aged somewhat in the past 10 years. His hair and beard were iron gray now. There were a few more lines in his face, but there were no signs of feebleness there. He wore a mail shirt and a silver surcoat. As Sparhawk entered the room, he rose and came around the table. "I was about to send a rescue party to the palace for you," he said, grasping Sparhawk's armored shoulders. "You shouldn't have gone there alone, you know." "Maybe not, but things worked out all right." Sparhawk removed his gauntlets and helmet, laying them on the table. Then he unfastened his sword from its studs and laid it beside them. "It's good to see you again, Vanyan," he said, taking the older man's hand in his. Vanyan had always been a stern teacher, tolerating no shortcomings in the young knights he had trained to take their places in Pandian ranks. Although Sparhawk had come close to hating the man during his novitiate, he now regarded the blunt-spoken preceptor as one of his closest friends, and their handclasp was warm, even affectionate. Then the big knight turned to the woman. She was small and had that peculiar neat perfection one sometimes sees in small people. Her hair was as black as night, though her eyes were a deep blue. Her features were obviously not Eline, but had that strangely foreign cast that marked her as Styric. She wore a soft, white robe, and there was a large book on the table in front of her. "Sophronia," he greeted her warmly, "you're looking well." He took both of her hands in his and kissed her palms in the ritual Styric gesture of greeting.
"You have been long away, Sir Sparhawk," she replied. Her voice was soft and musical and had an odd, lilting quality to it.
"And will you bless me, little mother?" he asked, a smile touching his battered face. He knelt before her. The form of address was Styric, reflecting that intimate personal connection between teacher and pupil, which had existed since the dawn of time.
"Gladly."
She lightly touched her hands to his face and spoke a ritual benediction in the Styric tongue.
"Thank you," he said simply.
Then she did something she rarely did. With her hand still holding his face, she leaned forward and lightly kissed him.
"Welcome home, dear one," she murmured.
"It's good to be back," he replied. "I've missed you." "Even though I scolded you when you were a boy?" she asked with a gentle smile.
"Scoldings don't hurt that much," he laughed. "I even miss those for some reason."
"I think perhaps we did well with this one, Vanyan," she said to the preceptor. "Between us, we've made a good Pandian."
"One of the best," Vanyan agreed.
"I think Sparhawk's what they had in mind when they formed the Order."
Sophronia's position among the Knights Pandian was a peculiar one. She had appeared at the gates of the Order's mother house at Deimos upon the death of the Styric tutor who had been instructing the novices in what the Styrics referred to as the secrets. She had neither been selected nor summoned, but had simply appeared and taken up her predecessor's duties. Generally, Eline's despised and feared Styrics. They were a strange, alien people who lived in small, rude clusters of houses deep in the forest and mountains. They worshipped strange gods and practiced magic. Wild stories about hideous rites involving the use of Eline blood and flesh had circulated among the more gullible in Eline society for centuries. And periodically, mobs of drunken peasants would descend on unsuspecting Styric villages bent on massacre. The church vigorously denounced such atrocities. The church knights, who had come to know and respect their alien tutors, went perhaps a step further than the church, letting it be generally known that unprovoked attacks on Styric settlements would result in swift and savage retaliation. Despite such organized protection, however, any Styric who entered an Eline village or town could expect taunts and abuse and, not infrequently, showers of stones and offal. Thus, Sophronia's appearance at Deimos had not been without personal risks. Her motives for coming had been unclear, but over the years she had served faithfully to a man the Pandians had come to love and respect her. Even Vanyan, the preceptor of the Order, frequently sought her counsel. Sparhawk looked at the volume lying on the table before her.
A book, Sophronia? He said in mock amazement.
Has Vanyan finally persuaded you to learn how to read?
You know my beliefs about that practice, Sparhawk, she replied. I was merely looking at the pictures.
She pointed at the brilliant illuminations on the page.
I was ever fond of bright colors.
Sparhawk drew up a chair and sat, his armor creaking.
You saw Alana? Vanyan asked, resuming his seat across the table.
Yes. Sparhawk looked at Sophronia. How did you do that? He asked her. Seal her up like that, I mean.
It's a bit complex.
Then she stopped and gave him a penetrating look.
Perhaps you're ready, at that, she murmured.
She rose to her feet.
Come over here, Sparhawk, she said, moving towards the fireplace.
Puzzled, he rose and followed her.
Look into the flames, dear one, she said softly, using that odd styric form of address she had used when he was her pupil.
Compelled by her voice, he stared at the fire. Faintly, he heard her whispering in styric, and then she passed her hand slowly across the flames. Unthinking, he sank to his knees and stared into the fireplace. Something was moving in the fire. Sparhawk leaned forward and stared hard at the little, bluish curls of flame dancing along the edge of a charred oak log. The blue color expanded, growing larger and larger, and within that nimbus of coruscating blue, he seemed to see a group of figures that wavered as the flame flickered. The image grew stronger, and he realized that he was looking at the semblance of the throne room in the palace, many miles away. 12 armored Pandians were crossing the flagstone floor, bearing the slight figure of a young girl. She was born, not upon a litter, but upon the flat sides of a dozen gleaming sword blades held rock steady by the 12 black-armored and visored men. They stopped before the throne, and Sophronia's white-robed figure stepped out of the shadows. She raised one hand, seeming to say something, though all Sparhawk could hear was the crackling flames. With a dreadful jerking motion, the young girl sat up. It was Alana. Her face was distorted, and her eyes wide and vacant. Without thinking, Sparhawk reached towards her, thrusting his hand directly into the flames.
No, Sophronia said sharply, pulling his hand back. You may watch only.
The image of Alana, trembling uncontrollably, jerked to its feet, following, it seemed, the unspoken commands of the small woman in the white robe. Imperiously, Sophronia pointed at the throne, and Alana stumbled, even staggered up the steps of the dais to assume her rightful place. Sparhawk wept. He tried once again to reach out to his queen, but Sophronia held him back with a gentle touch that was strangely like an iron chain.
Continue to watch, dear one, she told him.
The 12 knights then formed a circle around the enthroned queen and the white-robed woman standing at her side. Reverently, they extended their swords so that the two women on the dais were ringed in steel. Sophronia raised her arms and spoke. Sparhawk could clearly see the strain on her face as she uttered the words of an incantation he could not even begin to imagine. The point of each of the 12 swords began to glow and grew brighter and brighter, bathing the dais in intense, silvery white light. The light from those sword tips seemed to coalesce around Alana and her throne. Then Sophronia spoke a single word, bringing her arm down as she did so in a peculiar cutting motion. In an instant, the light around Alana solidified, and she became as she had been when Sparhawk had seen her in the throne room that morning. The image of Sophronia, however, wilted and collapsed on the dais beside the crystal-encased throne. The tears were streaming openly down Sparhawk's face, and Sophronia gently enfolded his head in her arms, holding him to her.
It is not easy, Sparhawk, she comforted him. To look thus into the fire opens the heart and allows what we really are to emerge. You are gentler far than you would have us believe.
He wiped at his eyes with the back of his hand. How long will the crystal sustain her? He asked.
For as long as the 13 of us who were there continue to live,
Sophronia replied.
A year at most, as you Alines measure time.
He stared at her.
It is our life force that keeps her heart alive. As the seasons turn, we will one by one drop away, and one of us, who was there, will then have to assume the burden of the fallen. Eventually, when we have each and every one given all we can, your queen will die.
No, he said fiercely. He looked at Vanyan. Were you there too?
Vanyan nodded.
Who else?
It wouldn't serve any purpose for you to know that, Sparhawk. We all went willingly, and we knew what was involved.
Who's going to take up the burden you mentioned? Sparhawk asked Sophronia.
I will. We're still arguing that point, Vanyan disagreed. Any one of us who were there can do it, actually. Not unless we modify the spell, Vanyan, she told him just a bit smugly. We'll see, he said.
But what good does it do? Sparhawk demanded.
All you've done is to give her a year more of life at a dreadful cost, and she doesn't even know.
If we can isolate the cause of her illness and find a cure, the spell can be reversed, Sophronia replied. We have suspended her life to give us time.
Are we making any progress?
I've got every physician in Alenia working on it, Vanyan said. And I've summoned others from various parts of Eosia. Sophronia's looking into the possibility that the illness may not be of natural origin. We've encountered some resistance, though. The court physicians refuse to cooperate.
I'll go back to the palace, then, Sparhawk said bleakly. Perhaps I can persuade them to be more helpful.
We thought of that already, but Anius has them all closely guarded.
What is Anius up to? Sparhawk burst out angrily. All we want to do is restore Illana. Why is he putting all these stumbling blocks in our path? Does he want the throne for himself?
I think he has his eyes on a bigger throne, Vanyan said. The archprelate Clavonus is old and in poor health. I wouldn't be at all surprised if Anius believed that the mitre of the archprelacy might fit him.
Anius? Archprelate? Vanyan, that's an absurdity.
Life is filled with absurdity, Sparhawk. The militant orders are all opposed to him, of course, and our opinion carries a great deal of weight with the church aristocracy. But Anius has his hands in the treasury of Alenia up to the elbows, and he's very free with his bribes. Illana would have been able to cut off his access to that money, but she fell ill. That may have something to do with his lack of enthusiasm about her recovery.
And he wants to put Orisa's bastard on the throne to replace her?
Sparhawk was growing angrier by the minute.
Vanyan, I've just seen Lychius. He's weaker and stupider than King Aldrius was. Besides, he's illegitimate.
Vanyan spread his hands. A vote on the royal council could legitimize him, and Anius controls the council.
Not all of it, he doesn't, Sparhawk grated. Technically, I'm also a member of the council, and I think I might just want to sway a few votes if that ever came up. A public duel or two might change the minds of the council.
You're rash, Sparhawk, Sophronia told him.
No, I'm angry. I feel a powerful urge to hurt some people.
Vanyan sighed.
We can't make any decisions just yet, he said.
Then he shook his head and turned to another matter.
What's really going on in Rendor? He asked. Vorin's reports were all rather carefully worded in the event they fell into unfriendly hands.
Sparhawk rose and went to one of the embrasured windows with his black cape swirling about his ankles. The sky was still covered with dirty-looking cloud, and the city of Samura seemed to crouch beneath that scud, as if clenched to endure yet another winter.
It's hot there, he mused, almost as if to himself, and dry and dusty. The sun reflects back from the walls and pierces the eye. At first light,
Before the sun rises and the sky is like molten silver, veiled women in black robes and with clay vessels on their shoulders pass in silence through the streets on their way to the wells.
I've misjudged you, Sparhawk, Sophronia said in her melodic voice. You have the soul of a poet.
Not really, Sophronia. It's just that you need to get the feel of Rendor to understand what's happening there. The sun is like the blows of a hammer on the top of your head, and the air is so hot and dry that it leaves no time for thought. Rendor seeks simplistic answers. The sun doesn't give them time for pondering. That might explain what happened to Ishand in the first place. A simple shepherd with his brains half-baked out isn't the logical receptacle for any kind of profound epiphany. It's the aggravation of the sun, I think, that gave the Ishandis heresy its impetus in the first place. Those poor fools would have accepted any idea, no matter how absurd, just for the chance to move around and, perhaps, find some shade.
That's a novel explanation for a movement that plunged all of Eosia into 3 centuries of warfare, Vanyan observed.
You have to experience, Sparhawk told him, returning to his seat. Anyway, one of those sun-baked enthusiasts arose at Debauer about 20 years ago.
Arisham? Vanyan surmised. We've heard of him.
That's what he calls himself, Sparhawk replied. He was probably born with a different name, though. Religious leaders tend to change their names fairly often to fit the prejudices of their followers. From what I understand, Arisham is an unlettered, unwashed fanatic with only a tenuous grip on reality. He's about 80 or so, and he sees things and hears voices. His followers have less intelligence than their sheep. They'd gladly attack the kingdoms of the north, if they could only figure out which way north is. That's a matter of serious debate in Rendor. I've seen a few of them. These heretics that send the members of the aristocracy in Krellos trembling to their beds every night are little more than howling desert dervishes, poorly armed and with no military training. Frankly, Vanyan, I'd worry more about the next winter storm than any kind of resurgence of the Ishandis heresy in Rendor.
That's blunt enough.
I've just wasted 10 years of my life on a non-existent danger. I'm sure you'll forgive a certain amount of discontent about the whole thing.
Patience will come to you, Sparhawk, Sophronia smiled, once you have reached maturity.
I thought I already had.
Not by half.
He grinned at her. Just how old are you, Sophronia? He asked. Her look was filled with resignation.
What is it about you Pandians that makes you all ask that same question? You know I'm not going to answer you. Can't you just accept the fact that I'm older than you are and let it go at that?
You're also older than I am, Vanyan added. You were my teacher when I was no older than those boys who guard my door.
And do I look so very, very old?
My dear Sophronia, you're as young as spring and as wise as winter. You've ruined us all, you know. After we've known you, the fairest of maidens have no charm for us.
Isn't he nice?
She smiled at Sparhawk.
Surely no man alive has so beguiling a tongue.
Try him sometime when you've just missed a pass with the lance, Sparhawk replied sourly. He shifted his shoulders under the weight of his armor. What else is afoot? I've been gone a long time and I'm hungry for news.
Otha's mobilizing, Vanyan told him. The word that's coming out of Zemok is that he's looking eastward towards Darizia and the Tamul Empire, but I've got a few doubts about that. And I have more than a few, Sophronia agreed. The kingdoms of the west are suddenly awash with Styric vagabonds. They camp at crossroads and hawk the rude goods of Styricum, but no local Styric band acknowledges them as members. For some reason, the Emperor Otha and his cruel master have inundated us with watchers. Azash has driven the Zemox to attack the west before. Something lies hidden here that he desperately wants, and he's not going to find it in Darizia.
There have been Zemok mobilizations before, Sparhawk said, leaning back. Nothing ever came of it.
I think that this time might be a bit more serious, Banyan disagreed. When he gathered his forces before, it was always on the border. As soon as the four militant orders moved into Lamorkan to face him, he disbanded his armies. He was testing us, nothing more. This time, though, he's massing his troops back behind